Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Barack Obama and John McCain standing today at Ground Zero in New York, an image of solidarity at a time when Americans are hungry to celebrate a comeback. But Ground Zero is not rebuilt. America's standing in the world is, by many measures, in trouble. And Al-Qaeda is back on the Afghan border. So who's won what here? And what should the U.S. strategy be now? This hour on point 7 years and counting after 9/11, who's winning? And what next? You can join the conversation. Where did you imagine we'd be 7 years after 9/11? Are we there yet? Joining us first today from Berlin is Craig Whitlock, a staff writer for The Washington Post, who's just been out on the Afghanistan-Pakistan frontier covering Al-Qaeda's comeback there and U.S. efforts to hit back. Craig, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
You describe a new strategy in the effort to get at Al-Qaeda leadership and at bin Laden in particular. Give us the basics.
Essentially, the U.S. government feels very strongly that bin Laden and other Al-Qaeda senior leaders are based in the tribal regions of Pakistan, which are near the Afghan border. This is a very remote territory, but it's also an area that U.S. operatives are very restricted from operating in. There are some CIA officers on the ground, but they're largely restricted to Pakistani military bases. U.S. forces are prohibited by Pakistan from operating on their territory. So it's a very difficult place for them to hunt for bin Laden and his deputies. So one thing, as we reported, that they're increasingly doing is they're doing this through the skies, through the use of these unmanned Predator drones, which are planes that have no pilots but are able to have cameras to look on the ground and fire hellfire missiles on their targets. What we've seen so far this year are at least 8 attacks by Predators on targets in western Pakistan compared to just 3 or 4 last year. So there's been a significant surge in these attacks in Pakistan, and this is really one of the primary methods that the U.S. government is using to chase after Al-Qaeda and Taliban leaders in Pakistan.
You quote a lot of officials saying they're very frustrated with the failure to find bin Laden, and they're citing the reasons why they think bin Laden hasn't been found, and Al-Qaeda has, in many estimates, now been able to rebuild in this area.
That's right. Of course, it's extraordinary, really, that bin Laden is still alive 7 years after September 11, 2001, and there has been no sighting, no trace of him since he escaped from the Battle of Tora Bora, Afghanistan, in December 2001. He's really melted into the landscape. And U.S. officials are really trying to constantly test their assumptions about this. Why haven't they been able to find him? Where has their strategy failed? And really, one thing that leaps out ahead of others is they say they really have a lack of what they call human intelligence. They don't have any good informants or tipsters that are anywhere close to bin Laden's inner circle who are telling him about his movements. Not only do they not know where he is now, but they have no idea where he was last month or 6 months ago or a year ago. They're really casting about in remote areas of Pakistan and just don't know where he is.
You also write that officials attribute the failure to an over-reliance on military force, to disruptions posed by the war in Iraq, and to a pattern of underestimating the enemy.
That's correct. I think this use of military force that has been part of the pattern in Afghanistan, many U.S. officials feel has backfired. This idea of just dropping bombs to attack Taliban targets has alienated a good portion of the local population, particularly the Pashtun tribes who cross back and forth between Afghanistan and Pakistan. Their allegiance has certainly strengthened toward the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and other groups. They see the United States as an invader, an occupier, who, even though on one hand they're trying to help rebuild Afghanistan and have spent billions of dollars doing this, we still see almost weekly, if not daily, you know, casualties resulting from that among the civilian population. And this is really taking a toll, making it very difficult, again, getting back to getting informants or tipsters to help the United States find these al-Qaeda leaders.
Now, Craig, we had kind of had the impression from the administration comments over several years that al-Qaeda was on the run. But now you're quoting Ted Gistaro, who's the U.S. government's top intelligence analyst for al-Qaeda, saying in a speech last month that Osama bin Laden remains al-Qaeda's authoritative source for strategic and tactical guidance, that he and Ayman al-Zawahiri continue to maintain al-Qaeda's unity and its focus on their strategic vision and operational priorities. It doesn't exactly sound like an organization scattered and on the run.
That's correct. You're right. President Bush and other senior administration officials for many years after September 11, 2001, had said that al-Qaeda was on the run, its operational abilities and capabilities were severely constrained, and for a time that was true. Al-Qaeda suffered many leadership losses after September 11th. They were on the run, but what they did is they picked up and they ran across the border to Pakistan, and over the past few years, they've slowly been able to rebuild and use that as a new refuge for their base of operations. Part of the reason for this is the U.S. was distracted by what was going on in Iraq. They sent a number of intelligence officers, spy planes, equipment, and really just the attention of the government was consumed by what was going on in Iraq, and less was spent on what was going on with al-Qaeda, which was able to rebuild the ability of its central command under bin Laden in Pakistan. And this has happened gradually over the past few years. But now it is the official conclusion of the United States intelligence agencies that al-Qaeda has come back. And it does have, if not as much capability to attack the West as it did in 2001, something close to it.
Craig, you quote the former chief of the CIA's bin Laden unit, Michael Scheuer, saying, "Our options are terrible. The new president will inherit a fish that is really starting to smell." We read in the headlines today that President Bush secretly signed in June, July, orders allowing special operations units, American military, to carry out ground assaults inside Pakistan without prior approval of the Pakistani government. So are they moving now to be more aggressive on the ground, not just from Hellfire missiles and Predators?
That's right. Something that happened last week was very important. There was an operation carried out by U.S. commandos, special forces, who crossed from their base in Afghanistan over the border into Pakistan, about 20 miles inside the line in North Waziristan, to attack a Taliban al-Qaeda compound, or at least where there were suspected militants who had been based there. They killed perhaps up to 15 to 20 people and went back out on helicopters over to Afghanistan. This was something that was done without notifying the Pakistani government in advance. It was very unusual. There have only been one or two other raids such as this over the past 4 or 5 years. This is in addition, of course, to these Predator attacks, which are carried out by unmanned planes. This attack by special forces on the ground is something that's still extremely controversial within the U.S. government. It's something they've been building toward for some time. They've been afraid at what kind of reaction this will provoke among the Pakistani public, which is very upset about it, as well as among the Pakistani government. But I think there's also a sense of frustration among the U.S. government and intelligence agencies that their options really are limited otherwise for chasing after al-Qaeda and Taliban leaders. You know, it's one thing to use these spy planes to chase them around, but really, northwestern Pakistan has been a haven for these people, and the U.S. government feels that the Pakistani armed forces aren't doing nearly enough to chase them down or track them down. So, hence this ground operation last week, and it will be very interesting to see if this is something that will be repeated in the coming weeks, or if it was really just a warning of sorts to the Pakistani government that they need to get more aggressive as well.
7 years on, al-Qaeda rebuilt on the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. Craig Whitlock, just back from there, joining us today from Berlin. Thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Joining me now from Vancouver is Bruce Hoffman, a world-renowned expert on terrorism and insurgency, professor of security studies at Georgetown University, previously led counterterrorism and counterinsurgency work at the RAND Corporation. Bruce Hoffman, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
And with me in our studio, Stephen Van Evra, professor of political science at MIT, expert on foreign policy and security policy, recently contributed an essay to the new book, To Lead the World, American Strategy After the Bush Doctrine. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, Tom.
Bruce Hoffman, Osama bin Laden had big plans with his attack, and it wasn't just to hit New York, though that was there, but he wanted to entangle, bleed, weaken the U.S. How's he doing?
Well, I think on a tactical level, he's a lot to take satisfaction for. He hasn't won this war, but at the same time, though, I think he's undeniably changed the course of history. He elevated terrorism to the top of U.S. and world national security priorities. He's forced us to spend enormous amounts in Iraq and in Afghanistan, but even more so on a daily basis, an hourly basis throughout the world, just on security measures. And he sees this struggle as generational and as epic in proportions. And his fundamental belief is that, unlike a conventional opponent, he will not defeat us on the battlefield, but rather, first and foremost, he'll bankrupt us. Secondly, he'll demoralize us. Now, he hasn't achieved any of those things, but I think just the fact that, firstly, last month, Al-Qaeda celebrated its 20th anniversary, that the movement has been able to last that long, it's demonstrated an enormous resiliency and implacability, and he believes that they can just continue to soldier on and eventually will be triumphant.
That is not what we expected to hear 7 years on, but we're dealing with it today. Stephen Van Evra, I'll come to you just after a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking today on the 7th anniversary of the attacks of 9/11 about American global strategy, what Al-Qaeda has won, where America stands, what we've won or lost, and what needs to come next. We're joined by Stephen Van Evra of MIT and Bruce Hoffman, now at Georgetown University. Stephen Van Evra, big picture, it's 7 years now. We need some big conclusions here, and we're at a very important point for American democracy about to vote on, in effect, what path we may take. How do you judge what's happened over these years in terms of American standing, American security, Americans' safety, capital S?
I think the results of the war in Al-Qaeda are unacceptable. 7 years on, Al-Qaeda is still as strong as they were before 9/11, or nearly as strong, as Bruce Hoffman was saying earlier. They still pose a grave threat to the United States. They're still trying to acquire weapons of mass destruction, and if they do acquire them, the barriers between them and us are very thin. The risk is great that they'll bring them here and use them. We won World War II in less than 4 years, and we're getting into a point here where we've been at this nearly twice as long as FDR was at winning World War II, and you'd expect success by this point. We're not seeing it. Instead, we're really being stalemated. Al-Qaeda's, I think they've won by surviving. They're still in the game. They've recreated the conditions that allowed them to grow like Topsy in the 90s by recreating a sanctuary in northwest Pakistan. And that's key to their organizational growth and health. They grew in the 90s because they had a secure place in Afghanistan.
And incredibly, they have that again.
And once again, exactly. They've reconstituted that because we let them get away in 2001 and 2002. We let them escape from Afghanistan, which was a huge blunder. We had them cornered and could have finished them off.
Bin Laden, anyway.
Yeah, Bin Laden and also other leaders. There were two mistakes. One was at Tora Bora when we think we had Bin Laden cornered, and the other was later Operation Anaconda when we had other Al-Qaeda leaders cornered. And these operations failed because we drew resources off of the Afghan problem and the Al-Qaeda problem and moved things into Iraq, thinking that we'd already won against Al-Qaeda. And we hadn't, and we didn't finish the job.
Steve, Bruce Hoffman says Al-Qaeda wanted to bankrupt the United States, wanted to demoralize the United States, have not achieved those things. He said, and yet we read all kinds of news about real economic problems here, banks going out of business. I'm not saying it's Bin Laden pulling those triggers. But, when you look at the wider effects of this encounter and the U.S. response to it, we don't appear in economically better condition, and the national morale, what is it, 80% of people think we're going in the wrong direction? That looks like a measure of demoralization at some level to me.
Well, I think that he hasn't done much harm to our economy yet. He surely will if he achieves another big attack. The 9/11 attack was a measurable but not huge blow to the economy. We recovered from it. To me, the big success he's had against us is he has baited us into a self-destructive lunge misdirected lunge, or let's just say an imprecise lunge into the Middle East that has undercut our own national standing in the Mideast, persuaded many people in the Mideast that we are more of a threat to them than al-Qaeda. And that has created the conditions for al-Qaeda to continue to thrive and live, to continue to find sanctuaries, to recruit operatives, to recruit money. The war in Iraq has been gasoline for al-Qaeda's fire. Okay, it's persuaded many people in the Mideast that the al-Qaeda narrative is correct. We've basically behaved in line with the al-Qaeda narrative, which argues that the West is attacking Islam, and the last century is a century of unprovoked and unremitting Western predation against the Muslim world. And we've played to that narrative ever since 9/11.
Bruce Hoffman, you've said that the U.S. economic deterioration represents a kind of victory for al-Qaeda.
Well, I agree with Professor Van Averen. You know, we can't specifically link this to bin Laden, but we have to understand one key point. It's a matter of perception. And in bin Laden's book, in al-Qaeda's viewpoint, they claim credit for this. They believe they have achieved this. Now, whether they have or haven't doesn't matter. It's the power of their propaganda that they can direct to their own core political base to continue to motivate them, to continue to animate them. And they say, look, our plan was to wreck the U.S. economy. He points to, you know, the Fannie Mae and Fannie Mac. He's given videotapes that talked earlier about the audio tapes, rather, that talked earlier about the mortgage crisis. And he claims, and I'm not saying that this is anything close to reality, but he claims to his followers, see, this is what we're doing. We have to keep fighting, and we're succeeding. And that, I think, in large measure, accounts for al-Qaeda's resilience and longevity, is they believe the propaganda, and they believe in this upward trajectory that bin Laden portrays to them.
But this isn't just a contest of attitudes. I mean, we had just yesterday before Congress, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Michael Mullen, saying that, he said, I am not convinced that we're winning it in Afghanistan. He said he's convinced he can, but not convinced that we are. He said, frankly, we are running out of time, he told the House Armed Services Committee. This is our chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Defense Secretary Robert Gates said al-Qaeda is showing greater ambition, attacks increasing steadily there. Stephen Van Averen, this doesn't sound like victory on the ground or at the kind of economic triumph level or rally the world level.
Well, I think the trends are very bad. We're doing better in Iraq than we were 2 years ago, much better, and we're doing much worse in Afghanistan than we were 2 years ago. We're now losing more troops in Afghanistan than we're losing in Iraq. And the trends look very bad because al-Qaeda has the wherewithal to keep growing their organization in Pakistan. Their sphere of influence inside Pakistan is growing. They are extending their tentacles further and further toward the national capital. This means there are more and more people subject to their coercion, more and more parts of the country where they can recruit, more and more places they can engage in training. So the trends are unacceptable.
How much satisfaction should Americans take from the apparent turnaround in Iraq?
Well, it means that this distraction that we unwisely engaged in can finally perhaps come to an end in the next several years. But it still leaves us with this big problem, and it's not just Afghanistan. People should understand there's a twin problem, Afghanistan and Pakistan. We need a national policy for stabilizing and reorienting Pakistan. The reason things are going downhill in Afghanistan is because Pakistan is supporting the Taliban, and Pakistan is essentially allowing al-Qaeda to have a haven in northwest Pakistan. So we need to address two big problems in the region, Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Bruce Hoffman, J. Kofor Black was director of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center from 1999 to 2002. He was a key player in the hunt for al-Qaeda, well known for his give-no-quarter approach, as our guest Craig Whitlock describes him. He said, back then, when we're through with them, they will have flies walking across their eyeballs, he told President Bush shortly after 9/11. Now he's quoted saying, this may sound strange coming from a flies on the eyeballs guy, but the most important thing is support and aid to local leaders and the population. If you don't have that, you can put in all the divisions of troops, that is, you want, and it won't matter, saying there's limits to the military answer here, Bruce.
Well, there's two things. Firstly, 5 years ago, exactly on this date, Ayman al-Zawahiri, bin Laden's number two, issued a statement where he said, you know, we thank God for Iraq and Afghanistan. We have American forces where we want them, where we can bleed them to death. And I think we have to look at what's going on, too, as part of al-Qaeda, the consummate opportunist, taking advantage of our deployment, especially in Iraq and now in Afghanistan, to do just that. I think back then, too, the United States did have an attitude, and this has been brought out in Bob Woodward's book that's been serialized in the Washington Post this week, that we could just, you know, kill the bastards, kill the bastards, kill the bastards, in other words, that we could win this war through, in essence, decapitation. What we found in recent years is that that's only part of the solution, and that you have to have very sophisticated information operations. You have to provide economic development in the areas where terrorists, particularly on either side of the Pakistan-Afghan border, where terrorists are drawn into these struggles, not necessarily for ideology, but because of employment. And I think in the case of Pakistan, and I just got back from there 2 weeks ago, we've given Pakistan $10 billion, but as two GAO reports last spring revealed, there's been absolutely no accountability and no metrics, and therefore this critical hearts and minds dimension, as it were, this critical use of other tools to get the population less supportive of al-Qaeda and the Taliban and more supportive of ourselves, hasn't even started to be done. And that's partly our fault because of the complete lack of oversight, but it's also, I think, the fault of the Pakistani military, which I think still doesn't understand counterinsurgency, and themselves still aren't engaging in these activities with the money we're giving them.
And now you've got the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff again telling Congress yesterday, we can't kill our way to victory. Admiral Mullen said, no amount of troops in no amount of time can ever achieve all the objectives we seek. But I don't know if that message has really sunk in. Let's go to our listeners. Philip is calling from Nashville. Philip, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Very well. What do you see out there, Philip?
Well, I guess I'm a political science major at Tennessee State University, and what we were basically taught, or one of the things that they go about, is that terrorism is, the main goal of terrorism is just to create fear and cause fear and to cause a society to change their habits and the way they do things. And in that aspect, they've kind of won because we've had two major elections that won on the basis of fear and promoting fear, and the fact of how, what we do when we go to the airport now, we have to take off our shoes, the security, all these things, they've changed our behavior, which is basically the goal of terrorism, is to change your behavior and elicit fear.
So there's the fear piece, and we've seen a lot of it, but there seems to be, to me at this point, more than just fear at work. I mean, we've got real economic and global standing problems as well, but we'll look at that. Let me get another here from Burlington, Vermont. Corey, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me. My question is whether Osama bin Laden has become some of a metaphorical carrot for the military-industrial complex in their efforts to have a sustained state of war, especially in a time when many of the companies operating have become privatized. I'll take my comments off here.
Yeah, certainly. Halliburton's made a lot of money in Iraq and others as well, but this goes to fear again. Stephen Van Evra, are Americans, is the American government concerned enough about the continuing potential threat of attack? What do you think of the fear level in this country? Is it right? Is it self-damaging? Should it be higher, lower?
I think that a lot of the sort of terror hawks in Washington have used the al-Qaeda threat to sell programs that they want for other reasons. The military and the defense industries, in fact, aren't the answer to the al-Qaeda threat. We need a reorientation of our security policy toward a different defense establishment. F-22s and Seawolf submarines and so forth are things you use for warfare against big countries, major powers. And the tools we need to use to defeat al-Qaeda are entirely different and often non-military. We need to strengthen the State Department's ability to deploy arguments and propaganda abroad. We need to lock down loose nuclear weapons and materials around the world, which is a job for diplomats. We need to deal with failed states, which is a job for AID. So to me, the sort of military answer to this problem is a false answer, although you often hear that implied in our national debate, that somehow, you know, building up our traditional military services is the answer, but it's not the answer.
And yesterday, Admiral Mullen seemed, well, he might want to build the forces up, but he's saying very clearly we cannot kill our way to victory, and that's the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Bruce Hoffman, you must think about all this a lot. What to your mind, is the heart of the reason that this country has not been more effective in responding to what happened on 9/11? Why are we not in better shape today? 7 years is a long time. We took on, you know, the Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan in that time and dealt with them. Americans have done great things in seven-year stretches. Why haven't we been more effective in this seven-year stretch with this challenge?
much of the discussion that Steve and others have and the questions have raised explain that. I think we started out this struggle with a very narrow and very simplistic conception that we could kill our way to victory, just as we fought conventional wars, and that decapitation and, you know, President Bush Xing off on a wanted poster Al-Qaeda leaders would do. And we found out that it's much more complex than that, and that you have to involve, as Steve suggested and others, all the instruments of national power, information operations, economic development, political reform. Now, the interesting thing, at least from my point of view, is that in 2006, exactly 2 years ago today, the National Security Council issued a revised national strategy for combating terrorism, which was the new iteration of a rather poor document from 2003. Mm. And it says all of this. It says exactly this. It's a very nuanced, a very intelligent document.
2 years ago.
2 years ago. The problem is a lot of it hasn't been implemented. We just have an effective Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy, James Glassman. He comes into office with only 6 months left. He's doing great things, moving the United States and the State Department precisely along these lines. But it's just this belated recognition. And during that period, while we sort of slept, Al-Qaeda was able to regroup and reorganize and take advantage of precisely our inaction in this realm. For instance, today there are some 7,000 terrorists, more than 7,000 terrorist and insurgent websites throughout the world. There were fewer than a tenth of that 10 years ago. And this is one example how they've seized on information operations, propaganda, to fill a vacuum and to draw people, at least make them more sympathetic and supportive. And our efforts are still, right now, still at a very sort of infantile stage. We recognize we need more of this, but part of it is appropriations from Congress. It's easier to appropriate money for F-22s than it is for public diplomacy.
I still want to hear more about the why. 7 years is a long time. Americans aren't fooled. Why? Let's go to John in Foxborough, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hi. I have three questions. One is, I've always had a concern that the Bush administration never really wanted to capture bin Laden based on certain evidence and the way things unfolded. And then two other questions. One is, what do you think is the capability and possibility of an attack by Al-Qaeda or same before the elections this November? And lastly, and I don't mean to spread too thin, but do you expect, or what would you expect if we simply pulled out of Iraq and Afghanistan? Is there any way that we can do that and redirect the money for energy or such? And I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you.
John, that's a lot. Let's pick up one piece before the break. Stephen Van Evere, the chances of an attack before the elections this year and the capability of Al-Qaeda to mount such a thing.
Well, I think the chances are real. They've tried two major attacks against the U.S. since 9/11. They both failed. They tried the shoe bomber attack, which would have killed all the people on one of the jumbo jets. And then they tried 2 years ago a major attack on seven or eight jumbo jets coming out of London. Who knows? Bin Laden does like to play in our election politics. He made a statement shortly before the 2004 election that people think was an effort to influence that. So, and he's out there. He's able to strike, and let's hope he can't. I don't think he has any cells now in the U.S., and I think it's hard for him to act in the U.S. because I don't believe he has any cells.
But how would we know that? Can you say that with any?
It's true. You don't know what you don't know. You don't know what you don't know. But we aren't seeing any footprints from the cells. We don't see message traffic that suggests there are cells here that we're not aware of.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about American global strategy. 7 years after 9/11, what Al-Qaeda's won, where America stands, and what needs to come next. Bruce Hoffman is with us, professor of security studies at Georgetown University. Stephen Van Evere is here, professor of political science at MIT and contributor to the new book, To Lead the World, American Strategy After the Bush Doctrine. Stephen Van Evere, just before the break, we had a caller asking whether the Bush administration really wanted to catch Osama bin Laden. It seems a strange question in a way. It was President Bush who said, dead or alive, repeatedly, we will get him. What do you think?
Well, I think the dirty little secret is that the Bush administration underestimates the terror threat. They have never taken the Al-Qaeda terror threat, I think, fully seriously. They've talked as if they thought it was a vital threat and then not acted as if it was.
But I don't get that. They took us to we've gone into huge war. We've spent, you know, billions, trillions. I mean, it looks like a major, major effort. John McCain says now let's stay on the offense.
Well, if you go back to the records we have of what they were saying in the administration on September 11 and 12, 2001, they were immediately talking about how can we use this event as the excuse to go after Iraq, whether Iraq's involved in the al-Qaeda attack or not. In other words, they really saw the 9/11 attack as a sideshow? A license to go do things they'd already decided they wanted to do that weren't connected to terror. And the fundamental belief, which I do find puzzling, but I see it expressed again and again by top neoconservatives and others, is that a non-state terror actor really can't land a heavy blow, and that the only kind of terror in this world we really need to worry about is state-sponsored terror. And if we face an actor like al-Qaeda that really has no state sponsorship, in the end, it really can't mount a big attack. It really can't land a heavy blow against us. So that's belief number one. Belief number two has been a rather simplistic notion that it's sufficient to smash the states that sponsor terror. You don't need to do more than that. You don't need to affect opinion around the world. You don't need to deal with state failure or support development around the world. That the terror problem is really quite a simple problem. It has a simple answer, which is the smashing of states that support terror. And now that leads to this highly militarized approach that Bruce was talking about earlier. Let's, you know, kill our way out of this problem, when in fact the terror problem is a deeper, harder, tougher problem to solve. It's got deeper roots in society, and you've got to change opinion in society. You've got to find ways to motivate those who are supporting terror or lending tacit help to it to come to your side. You can't just shoot your way out of it. And the neoconservative and Bush administration belief is that it's a simple problem. It's a shooting problem, and it's a much tougher problem.
Bruce Hoffman, but to be fair here, you and others have said that in the world of Muslim public opinion, the tide is turning against al-Qaeda. Now, first, if that's so, why is that happening? And if that's happening, is that a silver lining here? Is that something that Americans can find hope in? And why is it happening?
Yes. Well, I mean, I've written about that. I think it's positive, but I think there's been a lot of overstretch in that. In a way, we've put a lot of attention on the change in Muslim opinion to compensate for our inability militarily to weaken al-Qaeda. What we've seen in the past year and more, polls throughout the Muslim world that showed declines in some countries for support for bin Laden, support for al-Qaeda, I think just as significantly in the past year, at least half a dozen leading Islamist ideologues, and even some who were present at the creation of al-Qaeda and were always al-Qaeda sort of staunchest propagandists and the theologians that they drew justification from, have repudiated and turned on al-Qaeda. I've been more skeptical about the long-term impact of that. I think that, you know, it's fine and that's great, but even in the darkest days following 9/11, I didn't expect the Arab street or the Muslim world to fall into lockstep behind bin Laden and launch war on the West. And it's, you know, it's not the middle classes or the intelligentsia that fuels a terrorist movement. I think as positive as those two developments are, firstly, polls in other Muslim countries show increase in Indonesia, for example, in Lebanon, in Kuwait, show increasing support for bin Laden compared to polls taken some years ago, or greater justification for the 9/11 attacks. What I think is happening is bin Laden and al-Qaeda is focusing on their political base, on their core constituency. Last year, al-Qaeda's media arm, As-Sahab, was basically putting out audio or videotapes at a rate of one every 3 days. I mean, as you pointed out in the beginning, talking with Craig Whitlock, hardly sounds like a group on the run when you can communicate that often. Last year's tally was more than twice as much as 2006. So it's very clear that al-Qaeda not only has the abilities to communicate, but also still believes that they have a message that resonates and a core audience that's receptive to that message. And that's the audience that they are now attempting to continue to mobilize in the struggle.
Stephen Van Evra, we've got here a report this week that the head of the U.S. intelligence community's top analyst there, Thomas Fingar, is preparing a big report for the presidential candidates, for McCain, Obama, to give them, to help them think about what the next president is going to face in global risks. And it's not a pretty picture. You know, they're saying, ready yourself for this. And U.S. dominance in decline, world reshaped by globalization, battered by climate change, destabilized by regional upheaval, shortages of food and water and energy. It says he foresees for the next president U.S. leadership eroding at an accelerating pace in political, economic, and arguably cultural arenas. That's tough for whoever steps into the White House. Do you see a clear choice for American voters, Stephen Van Evere, when they look ahead to these coming years, when they decide for who they want to step into their White House and the policies they represent?
I think Fingar's list of dangers is a very I agree with the list. I think the dangers that he points to are very big ones, and the common thread that runs through them is that they are very different from the threats we faced in the 20th century. The prime security threat we faced in the 20th century was that another great power would dominate Eurasia. And if it did so, it would then have enough industrial might under its control to create a war machine that could cross the Atlantic and threaten us. So for, you know, World War I, World War II, and the Cold War were all about preventing that from happening. These threats that Fingar is talking about are very different in appearance. They are basically threats from below or threats to us all. They don't emanate from other great powers like Russia or China. Rather, they emanate from terrorists who might acquire weapons of mass destruction, or they are threats to the global commons, if you will, threats to the world environment. And that what they suggest to me is that we need a change of focus in our whole foreign policy away from great power game playing and trying to contain or limit the strength of other great powers who, in my opinion, are not a threat to us. China will not be. Russia will not be. And instead are refocusing on the real threats to us, which are the spread of weapons of mass destruction, the growth of terror networks like al-Qaeda, and threats to the global commons like to the environment.
I want to ask each of you who's you think is more likely to act on that kind of change. Let's listen to the candidates. Here's John McCain from his acceptance speech at the Republican convention last week, promising to use all the options available to him to keep America safe and promote a peaceful world.
I will draw on all my experience with the world and its leaders and all the tools at our disposal, diplomatic, economic, military, and the power of our ideals, to build the foundations for a stable and enduring peace.
There's John McCain's promise in that political arena. Here's Barack Obama in his acceptance speech to the Democratic National Convention on August 28th, criticizing past American foreign policy under President Bush.
You don't defeat a terrorist network that operates in 80 countries by occupying Iraq. You don't protect Israel and deter Iran just by talking tough in Washington. You can't truly stand up for Georgia when you've strained our oldest alliances.
Bruce Hoffman, you know, those are political arenas, political speeches. Americans are going to hear a lot more of them before November 4th. But when you look at the impulses and the articulated plans and strategies of these two candidates and the situation we're in 7 years after 9/11, what do you see as the choice facing voters?
Frankly, I think the choice is very clear. Senator McCain really promises more of the same in essence. He doesn't really offer any kind of a break or any kind of an alternative vision to what the Bush administration has done. So it's, you know, I think for voters it comes down, do you have confidence in what President Bush and his administration has or claims to have achieved in the war on terrorism and that Senator McCain wants to continue? Or rather, as Senator Obama argues, that we need a new and different approach that combines both the overwhelming military strength that we have, but that uses it far more intelligently and uses it in tandem with our other instruments of national power that are non-military.
But McCain said right in the bit we used from his speech that he'll use all the tools at American disposal, diplomatic, economic, military, and the power of our ideals. I mean, that seems to be something like what you and Stephen Evere are describing. Do you not buy it, not believe it?
Well, I'd like to hear from both candidates, in fact, greater specificity, and I think that's what's been lamentable in the campaign thus far. Firstly, terrorism has hardly been mentioned. It's being mentioned more now on the 7th anniversary of 9/11, but it's still mentioned with very broad brushstrokes and without the specifics that the American public needs. That even goes down not just to the exercise of our force overseas, but even Homeland Security issues. I mean, what about the Department of Homeland Security? What changes do both candidates feel are necessary to strengthen and right that new bureaucracy? What about the Intelligence Reform Act of 2004? Has that gone far enough? Is the Director of National Intelligence exactly the type of position we need when that director, for instance, cannot set priorities for the agencies under his aegis, cannot determine budgets, cannot hire and fire people? That's the kind of specifics and nitty-gritty that we still see. But I, in broad brush strokes, I do see the difference between them.
Let's, Stephen in Denver, I want to hear you, but let's take a call or two from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Nick, you're on the air, Nick.
Hi, Tom. My thought is this. I certainly don't believe we're safer. I certainly don't believe we've made the world a better place over the last 7 years. And I think it boils down to an issue of nuance versus dogma or dogmatic thinking. And I actually looked at these two candidates heading into this election thinking they both understand nuance and shades of gray, but that McCain has recently veered off and drill, baby, drill as an example, and his VP pick seems to imply that dogmatic thinking or appealing to the dogmatic thinkers in the country may win the election for him. My question is, why is this country so in love with dogmatic thinking, and is there hope for us to evolve and understand that it's a nuanced world and we've got to behave accordingly?
Nick, thanks. Stephen Van Evra, I mean, Nick's looking closely here, and he sees maybe not just an administration, the Bush administration, which has had its failings here, but maybe an electorate, which, I don't know, might not be entirely open or ready to grapple with what he calls the nuances of what we're facing in the world, even in its own decision upcoming.
Well, I think public discourse in the U.S. about foreign relations is, you know, woefully thin and getting thinner as we teach less and less history in college and in high school. And, you know, we're going to pay for this someday if we don't restore the study of foreign relations and the, you know, press coverage of the world. We've cut, you know, all the networks have cut back their foreign correspondents in the last 15 years. And to me, you know, a country that knows little about the world will be hurt by it in the end. So, you know, I agree with Nick that public discourse is lacking here. And you know, his worries about McCain. What I want to hear from both candidates is that they promise and dedicate to refocus our national security efforts against the biggest threats we face. I want to hear them say they're going to set priorities among the threats in the world. They're not all equal. And Al-Qaeda is the biggest security threat, and global warming is the biggest non-security threat. And I want to hear them say they're going to focus on that. McCain, he sort of seems to have ADD. He talks about terror as the main threat, and then all of a sudden he's focusing on Georgia and Russia as prime security problems for the United States. These are trivial problems, and pursuing them too aggressively is going to damage the war on terror. We need Russia's cooperation against North Korean nuclear weapons, for example, which could fall in the hands of Al-Qaeda someday if we're not careful. We need Russia to help us with that. We need Russia to help us on Iran. We need Russia to help us locking down loose nukes around the world. And poking a stick in their eye over Georgia, I think, is immensely unwise. It shows a failure to set priorities. So I want to hear the candidates say priority number one is locking down loose weapons around the world, defeating Al-Qaeda, dealing with warming. Let's focus and set priorities. And I'm not hearing that from McCain.
Let's hear from another Nick in Boston. Boston Nick, you're on the air.
Well, Tom, thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me now?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm very frustrated that in this discussion, no one has injected the economic limitations that America may have to face. In other words, we talk about our strategic options as though we can afford any option at any time. And I do want to remind all of our listeners that Russia literally bankrupted itself trying to compete in the Cold War, and once it could no longer adequately address its population needs, took a huge drop as a world power. Shouldn't the U.S. recognize the reality that we may not be able to afford financially without impairing our economy some of these big war options, big militaristic options? And why is that? It may be politically unpopular to admit that, but aren't we reaching the limits of our economic ability?
Nick, thanks very much for that. Bruce Hoffman, what about the economic envelope around this whole conversation? Priorities, I mean, drill, baby, drill is part of that, a petroleum-based economy. And then there's just the Treasury issue. I mean, we're bailing out Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. That's how many billions, and we know what Iraq costs. You know, are there at some point, are we there already, just economic boundaries that will reshape the way we respond to these challenges, Bruce?
I'm not an economist, but it seems to me over the past 7 years it's very difficult to increase military spending, for example, at the same time as you're lowering taxes. So I don't see Americans' economic travails now as necessarily that we're approaching a nadir or that we're exhausting ourselves. It's more that we're not allocating our resources correctly and we're not spending wisely. I mean, the United States' percent of GDP on military spending is still higher than any countries in the world. I'm not certain that it necessarily has to get higher, but we just have to use, firstly, the $10 billion we give to Pakistan. We have to make sure that it's used far more intelligently, that it's directed, and that is actually in the service of a very clear strategy. And unfortunately, those three criteria have been absent.
President Bush, Stephen Van Evra, saying today on the anniversary of 9/11 that history will look back at America's response to the terror attacks and conclude, quote, "We did not tire, we did not falter, and we did not fail."
Well, I think we have failed. 7 years, and Al-Qaeda is still able to land a fatal blow. This is unacceptable. And, you know, clearly, if they've stalemated us after this amount of time, we're doing something wrong. And I think Nick asks a great question here. Do we have the resources to win this? And do we have to be, you know, pulling our horns because we can't pay for the war? Several of the most important things we could do to defeat Al-Qaeda are very cheap. This is what drives people like myself and Bruce crazy, is that some of the simple things like waging a war of ideas, pepping up the State Department's ability to argue and change the terms of debate overseas, we're only spending $1.3 billion a year on that now. If we doubled that, it would be, pennies. You wouldn't notice the cost. Pursuing diplomacy, trying to end conflicts elsewhere, same thing. Very cheap things could help us win.
7 years. Stephen Van Evra from MIT, contributor to Lead the World. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Welcome, Tom.
And Bruce Hoffman at Georgetown University, joining us from Vancouver. Thank you for being here, Bruce.
You're very welcome, Tom.
7 years. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.